from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. This is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century Guy, and I'm here with Peter Onuf.
18th Century Guy.
Sadly, our 19th Century Guy, Ed, is away this week, which is too bad for him, because we're going to talk for a minute about a person from his century, a Louisiana doctor named Samuel Cartwright.
He was greatly respected in the South. He was considered a rock star.
This is Catherine Bancoli Medina,
professor of history at Coppin State University in Baltimore, Maryland.
And she's been studying Dr. Cartwright for quite some time.
He actually served as an apprentice with Dr. Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia.
He was a big deal.
Benjamin Rush was as big as you can get.
So in other words, the guy was no quack. In fact, he was one of the most influential American medical figures in the years leading up to the Civil War, especially in the slaveholding South.
And one theory that he advanced was something called drapetomania. It sure isn't a disease that doctors would diagnose today.
It was an illness described and defined as one that causes enslaved persons to run away from slavery or to have thoughts of escape from bondage.
Okay, that was an illness.
Yes, yes. He considered it an illness. He considered it a form of mental illness akin to madness.
Wow. What was his treatment for this, I shudder to ask?
Indeed, you should. He had some interesting treatments with respect to drapetomania. One of those is the idea that if the slaveholder would keep the enslaved person in an infantile state or in a submissive state, that kind of treatment would help to cure the person from wanting to be free. And if that failed, then the slave owner or the overseer could resort to whipping as a prevention against running away. And it was recommended as a cure.
Cartwright's theory didn't only apply to African Americans in bondage. He thought the same diagnosis could apply to free black people as well.
Cartwright had particular condemnation for free blacks. He believed that free blacks more often suffered from his Negro slave disease than did the enslaved blacks. Because
sure. Well, they weren't being treated. They weren't being treated like children.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Cartwright specifically spelled out that whenever you find free blacks in their own communities, in their own enclaves, actually behaving as if they were free, they were the ones who were suffering the most.
A little over a week ago, the American Psychiatric Association released the fifth revision of its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM-5. Drapetomania isn't in it, but some new disorders have sparked controversy. According to some experts, this latest edition of the DSM will reclassify millions of previously normal people as having some sort of disorder. That's going to have serious consequences for insurance coverage, patient care, and drug companies.
So today on Backstory, we're going to look at the ways past generations of Americans have drawn the line between mental health and mental illness. Why have certain disorders disappeared at various points, only to be replaced by new ones? We got stories about a sleepwalker at the foundation of the asylum movement, about how a few simple words changed activists into schizophrenics, and about a test that tells us if you, yeah, you are susceptible to fascism. It's often argued that a diagnosis can be limited by language, that the very words used to describe an illness can determine who is seen to have that illness, and this can have very real implications for those people diagnosed.
In his book, The Protest Psychosis, psychiatrist and sociologist Jonathan Metzl looked at the new definition for schizophrenia that emerged in the 1968 version of the DSM. He discovered that it led to one particular demographic being disproportionately associated with the disease. Metzl's story begins with a man that he calls Caesar Williams, committed to Michigan's Ionia State Hospital for the criminally insane in the 1950s.
He would have a pretty stable life, and then all of a sudden, out of the blue, would be involved in kind of traveling somewhere spontaneously, spending a lot of money, money that he didn't have, and getting into particular fights. And one day, lo and behold, at a time of great stress in his life, his wife was about to give birth to their child. He ended up traveling to Michigan and getting somehow involved in a card game that turned kind of violent, probably because he didn't have the money, and ended up being arrested. And when he was arrested, was saying that he was royalty and the king and other types of things. And so he was sent first to jail, and after a prolonged period of solitary confinement where he was, I think, probably physically abused, was sent into a psychiatric hospital.
And what was his diagnosis?
He was given a diagnosis in the late 1950s of what was called psychopathic personality with psychosis. And what I found is that a lot of men like Mr. Williams, who were admitted in the 1950s and diagnosed with psychopathic personality disorder or antisocial personality disorder, found that their diagnosis changed while they were in the hospital, and particularly when the DSM-2 came out in 1968. New terminology, particularly the terms were projection, projected anger, anger and hostility, these terms became part of the diagnosis of schizophrenia in 1968. And what we see is that the charts of people like Mr. Williams change, in which the doctors literally go through and change the diagnosis from a personality disorder to schizophrenia.
Now, as I recall, Mr. Williams was African-American.
That's right. That's a very large factor in the way that his diagnosis played out. There's particular language that's actually coming from Black Power protests that makes its way into psychiatric definitions of schizophrenia in particular. And so there are a bunch of articles that I look at that are from leading psychiatric journals that talk about the argument, and this was not in any way made in secret. It was right there in the leading psychiatric journals of the time, that Black men who participated in civil rights protests were at risk of developing schizophrenia because protesting was driving them crazy. And in fact, they coined a new term in a journal called the Archives of General Psychiatry, one of the leading psychiatric journals in the country. They coined this term called the protest psychosis to talk about Black men who were protesting against the government or in Black Power protests who were developing schizophrenia as a result of trying to assert their civil rights.
Was there any discussion of paranoia? Because as we know in retrospect, some civil rights activists had good reason to be, quote, paranoid. Phones were being tapped.
It's funny because one of the cases that I look at is the case of Malcolm X. And Malcolm X had a, you know, at least according to the CIA file, it's kind of contested a family history of mental illness, they argued. And Malcolm X, you know, as much as anybody, had reason to suspect that the government was out to get him because he was being profiled, his phones were being tapped. And I've got the FBI profile, and they diagnosed Malcolm X with having schizophrenia, particularly because he was paranoid against the government. And even though it's incredibly tragic to read this file, you can't but think, like, of course he was paranoid against the government because right. The government was profiling him and tapping his phone. So a lot of leaders at the time had psychological profiles that were done by the government, and they had good reason to be looking over their shoulder.
So to return to the psychiatric implications of all of this, how did that influence Mr. Williams' life?
At the time, there were tremendous diagnostic shifts that were happening, but also governments were deciding, because a lot of these asylums were federally funded, what types of diagnoses warranted long-term stay in psychiatric hospitals. And certainly schizophrenia was identified as being a diagnosis that warranted more intense treatment and longer stays in an asylum. So by diagnosing a lot of these African-American men like Mr. Williams with schizophrenia, they really did increase not only the amount of time that these men were kept in asylums, but also limited their ability to contest their incarceration or being kept there. So I've got long letters and correspondences, for example, between family members and the doctors at Ionia, where they were saying, he's fine, let him go, we'll take care of him. And the response was, our job is to restore him to sanity. And because he had this schizophrenia diagnosis that implied that he was insane, it meant that he stayed in the asylum for quite a bit longer than he would have otherwise.
What do you do as a professor of psychiatry to ensure that the social context that you live in does not taint your treatment of patients?
That's a wonderful question. I've actually had instances in my professional career where patients have come into the clinics or emergency rooms where I'm working, and they voice exactly the themes that I write about in my book. So when I was in Michigan, I was working in the ER one night, and there was an angry African American man who was brought in by the police with, clearly having mental symptoms, delusions or hallucinations. And at that moment, I'm not going to say, we're suffering from a socially constructed condition here that we need to kind of look at culture. You know, I think that that's an answer that would be malpractice. But I will say that if we have to remember the lessons of history, which is that our diagnoses, for better or worse, are shaped by social and political and environmental factors, and probably psychiatry more than other specialties. And so the patient that I'm talking about was brought in, and even though he was clearly in distress, he was also talking about threats made against him by the police and uncertainty. And I think that in a way, for me at least, knowing the particular context of the history, I would hope changed the kinds of questions that I asked of this patient. I think all doctors, their main goal is to alleviate suffering, but I don't think that we need to automatically discount the content of symptoms. And so in this case, you know, I probably spent more time asking this person about, you know, his sense of safety and what the threat was.
Jonathan Metzl is the director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University.
I'm Peter Onuf.
And I'm Brian Ballow. We're talking today about the history of diagnosing mental illness in the United States.
The 1830s were a foundational time in treating the mentally ill. With the first state-run asylums cropping up across the country, medical authorities had to decide who to put in them. At first, that meant the criminally insane, prison inmates who were too dangerous to be around other, more stable prisoners. But in an effort to keep the asylum from becoming a rug under which to sweep society's worst, doctors began to look for other patients, more treatable patients, to commit. Eric Mennel has the story of one of those patients.
On the night of June 24th, 1833, Dr. Lemuel Belden received a message. There were concerns about the behavior of a young girl in Springfield, Massachusetts.
I was called under the impression that she was deranged, and such at first was my own belief. She was struggling to get out of bed, complaining very much at the same time of pain in the left side of her head. Her face was flushed, the head hot, eyes closed, and her pulse much excited.
Jane C. Ryder was a servant for a wealthy family, and she had a fairly long history of sleep disturbances that went back into her childhood.
This is Benjamin Reese. He teaches at Emory University, and he stumbled onto Jane Ryder's story a few years back.
It was reported that she often slept too long, and that as a child she had a number of episodes of sleepwalking, and those started to get more intense as she came to work for this family.
At first, the paroxysms...
A paroxysm is a fit or an attack.
...occurred only in the night, and generally soon after she went to bed. As the disease advanced, they commenced earlier. She then fell asleep in the evening, sitting in her chair, or rather, passed into the state of somnambulism. For her sleep, under those circumstances, was never natural.
So some of the things that she would do in the middle of the night would be setting the table perfectly for breakfast.
Having dressed herself, she went downstairs and skimmed the milk, poured the cream into one cup and the milk into another, all without spilling a drop. She then cut the bread, placed it regularly on the plate, and divide the slices in the middle. And this with her eyes closed. She finally returned voluntarily to bed.
And when she'd wake up in the morning, she'd wonder,
why had somebody else done my job for me while I was sleeping?
Eventually, word of Jane's behavior got around. Her sleep-induced chores were written up in the local newspaper, and people wanted to see for themselves.
People would show up to watch the spectacle of her strange nighttime activities. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear exactly how people knew when to show up, but there don't seem to be any reports of people turning away dissatisfied. She was something of a medical curiosity.
It got to the point where Jane was not only doing work in her sleep, she was undoing work. Work she was paid to do. Things like pulling clothes from her dresser and hiding them in places she couldn't find when she woke.
And apparently after a while, this became bothersome to the family that was employing her. They decided, and apparently Jane herself agreed.
Arrangements were made for Jane's removal to the hospital in Worcester.
The state lunatic asylum, which had only opened the year before.
Where she could enjoy that seclusion which seemed essential for her cure.
What's important to note here is that just a few years prior, Jane wouldn't have been considered insane. In the 18th century, insanity was an entire way of being.
A complete delusional set of beliefs or a kind of reversion to an almost animalistic state of behavior.
But by the time Jane Ryder was making breakfast in bed,
the concept of partial insanity took hold, and that is that you could be completely sane in most aspects of your life. Mm-hmm. But there would be one set of behaviors that could set you off, either religious delusion or some kind of fixation or troublesome behaviors in your sleep. So insanity started to become fractionalized in a way.
A lot of this was caught up in ideas similar to phrenology, that different areas of your skull revealed different personality traits. The skull, the brain, and madness were all being broken down into their component parts in the 19th century. And with medical advances, scientists thought that if you could locate madness, you could cure it. Essentially, everything must be curable. Which is exactly how Jane C. Ryder, a young female servant who sleepwalked, was placed in the asylum system, a system mostly populated by the criminally insane.
December 15th. Paroxysm rather singular. She is full of melancholy like a roguish child. December 19th. She was more disposed to melancholy. She once said her head ached and felt strangely. She appeared very much like a person insane. December 21st. Very well and wakeful all day, but in the evening had a paroxysm of complete insanity. Talked, ran about the house, and refused to take her medicine. When forced to take it, she shed tears and fell into a sort of hysterical sobbing, which lasted some minutes.
Belden thought the problems were food-related. Specifically, he blamed her restlessness on eating too much dried fruit. But even controlling Jane's diet didn't fix the problem. So doctors were forced to try more drastic cures.
To warm the feet, which were always cold, the nitromuriatic acid bath was prescribed.
She was given everything from opium to ether to medications that would make her vomit.
Her head was also shaved.
Leeches were applied. She was bled profusely. She had
leeches?
She was blistered also. Pus would ooze out. There was some thought that it would draw out whatever fluids were not harmonized within her body causing her to behave in this way. So she went through this very painful and difficult set of treatments and experiments. And after a while, it was clear she wanted to get out of there.
Kind friend, as it was your wish that I should write to you respecting my health, I have a good opportunity now.
This is from a letter Ryder wrote to Belden just before being dismissed from the asylum. And reading the letter, the words don't seem like those of a woman who's effectively been a lab rat for the past few months. They seem more like a woman who wants to leave and will say whatever she needs to make that happen.
I am very happy to say I'm much better now, and think that being a little more unwell than usual has had a very good effect. The time has passed very quickly.
Do the doctors in the end feel like they've cured her?
In the final write-up of the case, they said that her symptoms had become much more manageable, which was, in a way, an admission that they couldn't completely cure the problem. Hmm. Now, asylum superintendents at that time, they always had an out because they claimed that mental illness was universally curable if it was caught early in its development. Hmm. And so they often took pains when they couldn't cure somebody to show that this was a disease that had been growing for years and years before that it was ever brought to their attention. And the fact that Jane Ryder had been experiencing bouts of sleepwalking since she was a young girl mm-hmm. helped give them cover.
One thing that was interesting about this story is like where I can't tell if by putting her in an asylum, it's a humanitarian effort that they want to treat her. That seems like that's what Belden, the doctor, it seems like that's his motivation. But simultaneously, it seems like the family, her employers are trying to just kind of get her out of their hair. I mean, do you get a sense that both those things are working in confluence with each other or one is more powerful than the other?
I think both are working together and they're often indistinguishable from each other. The reigning idea behind the asylum movement was that all people had access to mental health and to productive lives. And that when medical conditions prevented them from fulfilling their potential, that society had an obligation to restore them to full capacity. That was the PR, and often the reality was quite different when mm-hmm. people who were simply inconvenient to others, as Jane Ryder seemed to become to her employers, found themselves incarcerated either through coercion or through outright involuntary confinement. That tension between the humanitarian mission and the control of unruly individuals was always present through the history of the asylum.
And we don't know what happened to her after she left the asylum?
Well, we know she went back to working as a servant. Mm-hmm. And periodically, newspaper and magazine reporters would inquire into the case and give brief accounts of how she was doing. But she slips back into the obscurity of the world of 19th century serving women.
It's strange to think that mental illness might have been a way out of that obscurity, even if temporarily. And it's difficult to know what Ryder was actually thinking. After all, she wrote these letters knowing full well they would be read by the doctors treating her. Whatever the case, it was these letters, and others like them, that helped give authority to the asylum movement, that helped launch a century and a half of institutionalization.
I feel as if I never could repay my friends for all they have done for me. Indeed, I know I never can. All I can do is thank them and deny myself everything that would be injurious to my health. I have nothing more present to write. Your most obedient friend, Jane C. Ryder.
Eric Mennel is one of our producers. Special thanks to Benjamin Reese for helping tell the story of Jane Ryder. His book about culture and 19th century asylums is called Theaters of Madness.
Hey, Peter. I never thought that a story about leeches would turn into a feel-good ending.
Well, it's an age of reform. This is the era of women's rights, of temperance, of anti-slavery, you name it. We can make things better. And, you know, I think that you can listen to the story and you hear optimism. You hear the possibility that, yes, these new institutions, maybe they are the solution. Maybe we can at least begin, because the idea of progress is not that you know everything now, but that one day you will.
Yeah, well, speaking of progress, it goes down the tubes as far as the asylum is concerned, because end of the 19th century, these are large institutions, two or three times the size. They're warehousing people who are chronically ill. And while the institution was able to serve Jane Ryder, it turns out
that for every Jane Ryder, there were three or four more people who needed this kind of care and couldn't get it.
Brian, I think this is a classic story that asylum keepers were too successful. In a way, they sold themselves to the larger public that they could do something. Well, they couldn't really do much, but they always could get people into these asylums and out of society, out of families. Troublesome people could be warehoused. So the success in claiming to be able to deal with people with these mental problems led to this paradoxical situation where they couldn't really deliver care because of the sheer numbers of people involved.
Yeah, and the irony, Peter, is they did cure a lot of people, or a lot of people did get better. Those people left the institution. So over time, you first had increasingly populations that were chronically ill. And then by the end of the 19th century, for very complicated reasons having to do with funding, you got more and more elderly people who pretty much went there to die. You know, Peter, for better or worse, the story of the asylum in America doesn't end there. In the 20th century, it morphs yet again. We called up Alan Horwitz, a sociologist who has written a lot about the history of psychiatry, and he explained what happened next.
For most of the 20th century, mental hospitals were at the core of the psychiatric profession, and most psychiatrists practiced in inpatient mental institutions. Really, it was psychoanalysis that made the major change, where they pretty much thought mental problems were just extensions of ordinary kinds of psychosocial problems.
In addition to the psychotic, who had long been institutionalized, psychiatrists began to focus on the neurotic, people who weren't in danger of being committed, but who needed help nonetheless.
So that instead of the sharp dichotomy between people who are basically considered crazy and those who are sane, what you get is a much more gradual transition between sanity and normality.
These gradations were laid out in a document the American Psychiatric Association released in 1952. They called it the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or DSM.
A second edition was published in 1968. Like the first one, it was intended as a compendium of the range of mental disorders and their probable causes.
So, for example, this is the entire definition of depression in the DSM-2. And it, quote, "This disorder is manifested by an excessive reaction of depression due to an internal conflict or to an identifiable event, such as the loss of a love object or cherished possession." That's it.
Wow,
it,
they violated my elementary school teacher's rule, never define something with the thing you're defining.
Right, exactly. Yeah, when it says it's manifested by an excessive reaction of depression, yes, it's quite circular.
Psychoanalysts were okay with these broad definitions. After all, they were mainly interested in the distinctive details of their patients' unconscious lives. But, says Alan Horwitz, there was a problem.
The major problem was that it's not a very medical way of thinking about things, that it didn't give you sharp diseases.
It was in this context that psychiatrists went back to the drawing board. And in 1980, they released a third version of their manual, the DSM-3. Alan Horwitz says it was nothing short of a paradigm shift.
DSM-3 really medicalized psychiatry. The criteria, say, for depression, you have five symptoms. If you have fewer than five, you don't have the condition. So you have the kinds of discrete categories that you have in other medical disciplines that you didn't have before the DSM-3.
The new paradigm was a real win for research psychiatrists who had been pushing for years for a more uniform way of talking about mental illness. And for pharmaceutical companies, who could now use that checklist to pitch specific symptoms to doctors and patients that they should look out for.
Psychoanalysts, on the other hand, weren't so happy because the new focus on symptoms left no room for considerations of root causes.
With the single exception of bereavement, there's no context in it at all.
What we're left with, says Horwitz, is a system that does not distinguish between real depression and the kind of temporary sadness that is the natural human response to a range of life events. Both are now lumped together into one diagnosis, which in turn frequently results in a prescription for drugs.
I think that psychiatric researchers are finding that the paradigm they've been using since the DSM-3 just hasn't worked very well, that it hasn't produced the kinds of breakthroughs regarding the treatments for conditions that they, you know, expected it would have. And I think there's a growing recognition that it's the current DSM system itself that is almost holding back progress. And many of the proposals that you see for changing it really do harken back to systems that were more common before the DSM-3 in 1980.
In other words, getting back to root causes. But these days, those causes are more likely to be seen in the chemistry of the brain than in uncovering the deep history of a person's mental suffering. When we get back, a psychological test that promised to identify people who threatened American democracy.
More backstory coming up in a minute. We're back with Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
And I'm Brian Ballow. Today, we're taking on the history of mental illness in America.
In 1950, four researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, published a 999-page study that would dramatically shape psychology for the next couple of decades. It was called The Authoritarian Personality, and it attempted to figure out why some people embraced authoritarianism while others didn't.
This research had begun in the midst of World War II, and two of the researchers, Theodor Adorno and Elsa Frankel Brunswick, had themselves fled Nazi Germany in the 1930s. So they had a very personal interest in this study. The big question was, might Americans ever embrace fascism on a large scale? Could anybody embrace authoritarian beliefs?
The answer they arrived at was essentially this. What made someone likely to embrace authoritarian politics was a specific type of disordered personality, close-minded, conformist, deferential to power. People with this so-called authoritarian personality, the researchers thought, posed a threat to America's democratic society. And so they put together a bunch of tests that could help identify these dangerous authoritarian types. There was the AS scale, which tested for anti-Semitism. There was the E scale for ethnocentrism. And then there was the F scale.
For fascists, yeah.
This is Jamie Cohen Cole, an assistant professor of American Studies at George Washington University.
So if you agree strongly, this is an indication that you are a fascist. Okay, so this is item number 31. Nowadays, more and more people are prying into matters that should remain personal and private.
I'm ambivalent on that.
You're ambivalent on that. Okay, so you don't point in either direction in that one then.
No, hit me with the other.
People can be divided into two distinct classes, the weak and the strong.
So everything is very clear cut if you're going to score high in this personality.
Yes. Item number 41. The businessman and the manufacturer are more important to society than the artist and the professor.
This has to do with psychology, not politics?
Okay, so the argument is that people who score high on this test, that is, who agree a lot with these terms, that they would score high on all of these things. So they're conventional. They have tendencies toward authoritarian submission. They have authoritarian aggression. They have anti-interception.
Anti-interception?
So they are opposed to the subjective, the imaginative, or the tender-minded.
So by covering these different realms, they really get at the essence of the individual, not just political views, or so they would argue.
Right. The larger conclusion was to argue that there was such a thing as an authoritarian personality, that authoritarianism was composed of these different subcategories that belong together, that fascistic kinds of thinking explain not only racism, but also anti-Semitism, and also explain certain beliefs about child rearing, certain beliefs about religion, certain beliefs about conformist behavior.
How was this received? Did this make a big splash? Did this make much of an impact in America in the early 1950s?
So, yes, it had an enormous impact. The members of the group that wrote this book were mostly left-leaning. They were generally opposed to McCarthyism and actually wanted to describe right-wing politics as being best explained by the categories of the authoritarian personality. And then what happened is that because it was picked up by so many social psychologists, but also by widely read sociologists and historians. So here it would be worth noting the work of Daniel Bell and his collaborators in a book known as The Radical Right. Collaborators included the historian Richard Hofstadter. For these social thinkers who were trying to explain how do we understand the way in which segments of American society supported clearly anti-American positions, anti-democratic positions that that Joe McCarthy was taking, the abridgment of the Constitution and, you know, rights to freedom association. And the way to make sense of this was to understand those members of the American population who had subscribed to McCarthyism, to understand them as having a certain form of mental illness in which they would be, you know, attached to a strong leader, in which they would assign all of the problems that they saw in national life and in culture to an out-group, that is, people not like them. So to communists, to minority groups, and that would then be the explanation of that particular problem.
Well, if I were a researcher, where would I look across the spectrum of American society to find these authoritarian McCarthyite types?
For the psychologist reading this book and the sociologist, the most obvious example of these people would be small shopkeepers, housewives, the kind of lower middle class. They're basically thinking about the prototype example of people who were the first joiners of the Nazi Party.
Yet the authoritarian personality, if I'm not mistaken, ends up getting applied to people on the left eventually. How does that happen?
So because this book was so important in the field of social psychology and sociology, it received a lot of attention for its methodological claims and the way that it understood individuals. And two modes of criticism made what you talked about happen, that is the application of authoritarian personality to people on the left. On the one hand, Edward Schills, who was a right-leaning sociologist, argued that all of the problems with the authoritarian personality, which if you read the book, seems to be mostly people on the right, could best be applied perhaps to Marxists, to communists. And so he wrote a lengthy critique of the authoritarian personality, making sure that we would think about how Marxists had all of the conformist irrationality that had been assigned to McCarthyites and to fascists. So that's part one. The other part is that social psychology has been struggling since its birth to claim that it is a hard science, that it is as good a science and as rigorous a science as the natural sciences. And one way to do that is to make sure that there's no politics involved. And so a psychologist by the name of Milton Rokic adopted a new term, closed-minded rather than authoritarian, as a way of talking about people whose political views were outside of the most common centrist views. And it's with that invention that the field of political psychology could claim that it wasn't only looking at people at the right, but simply looking at people who had unconventional political views.
So if the central concern of the authors of the authoritarian personality was avoiding conformity, avoiding rigid thinking, didn't they contribute to creating that kind of society by marginalizing so many different perspectives?
Right, indeed so. And that's one of the ironies of this work. And I mean, an even maybe deeper irony is that one of the ways that they said you could recognize an authoritarian personality is that they applied a categorical way, a bipolar way of understanding the world. That is, there's the inside group and the outside group. You know, there's Aryans and non-Aryans, for instance. And then they then proceeded to apply a bipolar way of thinking about right. American society. We have the authoritarians and democratic-minded. And it took really until the mid-60s when mostly people on the left started to criticize the framing of the authoritarian personality and closed-mindedness as producing conformity in and of itself.
That was Jamie Cohn Cole, an assistant professor of American Studies at George Washington University. His forthcoming book is The Open Mind: Cold War Politics and the Sciences of Human Nature.
If you'd like to rank your own level of fascistic thinking, you can take a version of the F scale on our website, backstoryradio.org.
At the beginning of the show, we heard a little bit about schizophrenia's history as a diagnosis. To end our show today, we're going to hear from a person who has firsthand experience with that diagnosis. Her name is Ellen Sachs, and she's a law professor at the University of Southern California. In 2007, Sachs published an autobiography that chronicled her own struggles with the disease. Peter and I reached her at her office.
So basically, schizophrenia, the analogy I give is to a waking nightmare with all the bizarre images, impossible things happening, and the utter, utter fear. Only with a nightmare, you sit up in bed, open your eyes, and it goes away. No such luck with a psychotic episode. So for me, my schizophrenia involves delusions, fixed and false beliefs without evidence, like that I've killed hundreds of thousands of people with my thoughts, hallucinations, like I remember once I saw a man standing with a raised knife, disorganized and incoherent thinking and speech. So I had a breakdown on the roof of the Yale Law School my first year there, and I told my friends, I said, are you having the same experience as I am of words jumping around the cases? I think someone's infiltrated my cases. We've got a case of joint. I don't believe in joints, but they do hold your body together. So words that are loosely associated but put together don't make any sense.
Professor Sachs, did you have experience in an institution? Were you confined to an institution?
I was. I was hospitalized in England, Oxford, England, in around 77, 78 for a month, and then the following year for 4 months, and then my first year at Yale Law School for 5 months, and that was 82, 83. I haven't been hospitalized since then, although it's been suggested on occasion, and in a way my proudest accomplishment that I've been able to function without being hospitalized again.
And how did you accomplish that?
Well, I mean, I'd like to say something first about my doctors, which since I've been hospitalized all those many years ago, I've had serious episodes and might have seemed scary and worrisome. And I really cherish and honor the fact that my doctors were willing to sit with a certain amount of anxiety about my dangerousness to myself and other people for the sake of respecting my wishes not to be hospitalized. Mm-hmm. It would have been much easier for them just to kind of throw the book at me, so to speak.
Yes.
With my friends and family, you know, I don't really show my illness except to, like, my closest friends and my husband occasionally. And they're wonderful. They're supportive. They're kind. You know, they usually say to me, and this works for me but not other people, Ellen, it looks like you're having a really hard time. Mm. It's probably your illness acting up. Let's call your doctor. Maybe you need to get on more medication. So for me, that kind of supportive response is extremely helpful. I have a bipolar friend I tried that with, and he got furious. How dare you say that? So it's not one size fits all. But I've had excellent treatment, 5-day-a-week psychoanalytic therapy for decades and continuing, excellent psychopharmacology once I accepted the need for it, and a really wonderfully accommodating workplace. It's a very intellectually stimulating place, and for me, using my mind to, you know, work on a puzzle or write an argument or a counter-argument is one of my best defenses against my mental illness.
Professor Sachs, since we are with one real historian, at least, Peter Onuf, I got to ask him, how would somebody who presented with these kinds of symptoms, how would they have been treated, Peter, in the 18th century?
Well, one solution is sequestration, to use a current term.
Uh-huh.
That's the legendary mad woman in the attic.
Right.
Being kept restrained. I mean, restraint is probably the common theme, restraint and isolation.
Right.
Given the fact that nobody understood what was happening, or they attributed it to demons or possession of some sort, or later on, more humanely, to environmental circumstances. There weren't any obvious and easy ways to deal with this. It's not as if people in olden times, just because they couldn't diagnose things, that they could deal, they could not deal humanely with these situations.
Professor Sachs, were you constrained when you were in institutions?
I was restrained, you know, for the first couple of days, 20 hours a day, and then for 3 weeks, maybe 5 to 15 hours a day for 3 weeks. It was incredibly traumatic. I had nightmares about it for years. It just, you know, you feel helpless, you feel confused, you never know what you can do to get out, you don't know how long you'll be in. Actually, being in restraints for over, you know, say 10 hours, your limbs really start aching, so it's very painful as well. And also, you know, there's evidence that it can be harmful. So the Hartford Current did a series about restraint deaths, and they had a Harvard statistician make some estimates based on the data, and he estimated that every week 1 to 3 people die in restraints. They aspirate their vomit. They have a heart attack. They strangle.
So I gather that restraints are still being used.
They are. There's kind of a trend to stop using them, but there are places that still use them quite a bit.
So you've been very gracious about the psychiatric profession, and in fact, you claim that they've helped you tremendously, yet they continue to use these restraints. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, what I like to say about treatment is that I'm very pro-psychiatry, but I'm very anti-force.
I see.
I think force is a terrible thing to do to another human being with a terrible illness. It's not a stable solution. Once you stop administering the force, the person has no incentive not to go back. And what I think we should do is study ways to get people to want treatment so we don't have to use force.
I want to take you, strangely enough, back to Peter's century, because you talked about friends, and I know in some of the material I've read about you, you have a very loving husband.
Uh-huh.
Clearly, medication has helped. Clearly, psychoanalysis has helped. But back in Peter's day, they had friends and they had family. Am I wrong about that, Peter? You had friends and family back in your period.
Yeah,
right?
we certainly did. Let's not romanticize them, though. This is the pre-romantic period. You're constantly under surveillance, and it may be the modern invention of surveillance and restraint is a substitute for the thick social relations of the early modern period.
Well, they actually say that people with schizophrenia do a lot better in developing countries than they do in industrialized societies, and it may be because families are closer and there's more tolerance of difference and that kind of thing.
I'd be curious to know what it felt like when you did reveal to the world that you're a schizophrenic.
You know, it's sort of interesting because one of my friends said that, you know, I should do it in my book under a pseudonym. Did I want to become known as, quote, the schizophrenic with a job? And I didn't want to become known that way. But then I thought I couldn't do anything, you know, that could be more helpful to people potentially than by actually telling my story. Because it's a story, thank God, that has a happy ending, and that may give other people hope and understanding, and that feels good to me. I'm part of Glenn Close's board that has members that study stigma, and they find that people coming to understand that mental illness is a brain disease doesn't reduce stigma, but people putting a human face on the disorder does. And especially if it's like at your workplace, you know, the person in the office next door has a mental illness, but you know, you see that they pretty much are just like you and they want the things that you want and they have the same fears and, you know, anxieties. And so I think coming forward is a good thing. It's easy for me to say as a woman with tenure, but other people are pretty established and could do it. And I think if they can, it's a good thing to do.
Well, you've done an amazing thing, which is to take responsibility for your life and the way you're treated, knowing that you're not fully responsible and you need help.
Right.
Seems to me there's a big tension, and it's very hard for us in our culture to resolve that, between notions of personal responsibility, which go back to the very idea of consent. The regime is based on consent. And on the other hand, taking care of others, that sense of social responsibility.
Right. Yeah, that's extremely well put. I think that's exactly right.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Professor Sachs. This has been so illuminating.
Well, thank you.
That's going to do it for today's show. As always, we've posted a whole trove of related web resources about today's topic at backstoryradio.org.
We'll be back next week with Ed Ayers in tow. In the meantime, please don't be a stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Chioki Iansen, Jess Angabretson, Eric Mennel, and Tony Field, with help from Emily Charnock. Jamal Milner is our engineer. Special thanks today Dustin Hapley, Paul Lerner, Alvin Poussin, Lena Richards, and Robert Spitzer. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham. Major support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the University of Virginia, Weinstein Properties, an anonymous donor, and the History Channel. History made every day.
Peter Onuf and Brian Ballow are professors in the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.